Today, we're going to discuss the Airports Commission, and we have Jeff Hamel, the Executive Director, with us today. Welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name for the record, appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jeff Hamel, Executive Director of the Metropolitan Airports Commission, here at your request today to talk about the Metropolitan Airports Commission and provide a fundamental background of the organization and kind of our activities and what our plans are for the fairly near future.
Thanks for coming. If you'd like to go ahead and start.
I thought what I would do, Mr. Chairman, is just do an overview, kind of a MAC 101 review of what the Airport Authority does and how we are constituted, our past programs that you've probably experienced or observed over the last several years as users of our facility, and then talk about what the future holds as far as future plans. Let me just get my notes pulled out here. The Metropolitan Airports Commission was created actually by the Minnesota State Legislature in 1943. It was the first of the commissions that were created for kind of a single-purpose focus. Our responsibility and job directed by the legislature was to promote a safe, efficient, environmentally sound air transportation network and system for the state of Minnesota and the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Back in the mid to latter 40s, it was recognized that air transportation following the war would be reliable and safe and international. And Harold Stassen, who was the governor at the time, basically strongly urged the legislature successfully to create an airport authority to represent the seven-county metropolitan area to provide the services needed to make us participants, to provide us the opportunity to be participants in the international air transportation network. And he went on at some length talking about our central location and central to North America and central to the country, and from the standpoint of international destinations and flying great circle routes over the poles to both Europe and Asia, provided us an opportunity to be a central, large aviation network and hub for the United States. The Airports Commission operates a system of airports. We have seven airports in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, of course, is our air carrier airport. It is the largest of our enterprises and one that's obviously most visible. We also own, however, the St. Paul Downtown Airport, which is primarily focused on business aviation, so you'll see a good concentration there of corporate flight departments such as 3M Company and several other companies that have a large corporate jet that can fly international nonstop out of the Twin Cities to their destination. It is identified in the Metropolitan Council's overall plan as an intermediate airport, which means that the runways are longer than 5,000 feet and can accommodate corporate jet type of aircraft of almost any category. In the case of St. Paul, it's about 7,500 foot is the longest runway there at the airport. It has all weather, all season instrumentation capabilities. You can fly in all types of weather conditions safely and reliably. Then there is a category of small general aviation airports in our system. On the east side of St. Paul is the Lake Elmo Airport, short 3,200 foot runways, primarily focusing on single engine, two and four passenger airplanes. To the north is the Anoka County Airport, which has a 5,000-foot runway newly expanded over the last 4 or 5 years or so, instrumentation for all weather operations, but cannot accommodate large-capacity commercial operators, but can accommodate the medium-sized to smaller jets and all prop-type aircraft. The Crystal Airport in Crystal is northwest, and that is, again, smaller or shorter runways, 3,400 feet in length. There are two parallel runways and a cross runway there for accommodating, again, the single engine and twin engine light prop aircraft, small business operators, no jets. And then on the west side of the airport is the Flying Cloud Airport, 5,000 foot runway and a 3,900 foot runway running parallel and a north south runway providing accommodation for adverse wind conditions. And that airport can handle the medium sized to smaller jet aircraft and all propeller driven aircraft as well. And we envision Flying Cloud Airport, and I'll speak to this later on, as becoming a growing corporate facility for the medium-sized corporate jets that can fly most anywhere in the U.S. domestically or Canada nonstop. And then to the south, we own the Air Lake Airport in Lakeville, 4,000-foot runway, primarily focusing on single and twin-engine propeller aircraft for both recreational and small business uses. Our board, which was created by the legislature in 43, as I said earlier, currently has 15 members on the board. 13 of those members are appointed by the governor of the state of Minnesota. However, they are staggered terms, so we don't have a total turnover of our commissioners when a new governor is elected. At the present time, the governor will appoint six commissioners, plus there will be a new chair, which is unusual. That's the largest turnover that I've experienced in my 4 years at the Metropolitan Airports Commission. The governor does specifically identify the chair as the chair, and there are 8 seats in the metropolitan area that he or she appoints, plus 4 greater Minnesota seats for a total of 13. The 2 remaining seats are held by the mayor of Minneapolis and the mayor of St. Paul. That provides the commission with input from the 2 major cities in the metro area. However, neither mayor serves themselves personally. They have representatives that serve on their behalf. As executive director, it is my responsibility to execute the operation of the organization, to respond to our chairman, our board of directors, and the governor's office and the legislature. I oversee the staff and its overall operation, and I'm responsible for the organization's operation. I am I work and serve at the pleasure of our board. One thing that you should be aware of is that we have a system of 7 airports in the metro area. That's a bit unusual. Most metropolitan areas in the United States do not have a system of airports. There may be 2 or 3 airports in a community, part of a network of airports, but usually communities that do own airports or have airports in their jurisdiction, either a city or county, operate the primary air carrier airport and don't necessarily spend a good deal of time managing smaller airports. And if they do, it's 1 or 2. The only system that's similar to ours is Miami-Dade County with 5 airports, a similar structure to ours. Overall, I would have to say that the Airports Commission operates and functions extremely well. It's a self-supporting organization. I'll discuss that more thoroughly in a few minutes. Probably one of the most visible and somewhat controversial issues that we've dealt with for more than 30 years is our noise mitigation program. Just to point out a couple of facts, between 2006 and 2014, in other words, about 3 years from now, we will have begun and completed the most extensive noise mitigation program in the United States. In fact, I think I would be very comfortable in telling you probably the largest, most extensive noise mitigation program in the world. We will have completed the insulation and or treatment or compensation of homeowners for noise mitigation. And this would be either doing the work ourselves or providing some sort of financial relief for folks who wish to do the work themselves or have someone else do it privately to insulate homes, to provide insulation in the attics, replace noisy windows and doors that leak noise and sound, roof vents, furnace systems, air conditioning systems. Depending on where you live in relationship to the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, the closer to the airport, the more mitigation you qualify for, because the closer you are, the louder the noise. As you get farther out, there are some programs that provide some financial rebate opportunity. But the total cost of this noise mitigation program during the 18 years of the program when it's completed in 2014 is somewhere in the area of about $450 million. That is not taxpayer money. There's no general tax revenues that come to the Airports Commission from the state or any other entity. The Airports Commission, simply through rates and charges on the airport, has financed this program over the long term to deal with the airport that's in close proximity to residential communities around the airport. I say so 16,000 homes will have been treated or financially compensated for over the course of the program. We've insulated, acoustically treated 18 schools within what's called the LDN 65 contour around the airport, and we've acquired 410 homes. Most of those homes acquired at the request of the cities that surround the airport. I've mentioned funding, so let me just discuss that topic for a few minutes. The airport is a self-supporting financial model. We receive no public authorization from the state of Minnesota. No general tax revenues come to the Airports Commission from the state's general tax fund. We have to generate our own revenues to operate the airport and to meet our debt service requirements. At the present time, we generate about $240 million a year in revenue to support and pay for the operation of the airport. And our current debt outstanding is about $1.74 billion. So how does the Airports Commission generate revenue? Where does it get its money? We basically rely on aviation grants. These grants come to us through the Federal Aviation Administration in Washington, D.C.
Excuse me, Director.
Yes.
Members, I've got a couple people, quite a few people who have questions. I'm wondering, should we allow the director to finish and then take the questions? Is that... because there's quite a few here. And is everybody okay with that? Okay, if you could just proceed, I mean.
Okay, thank you very much. If there's something that does pop up that really does deserve some attention at the moment, please don't hesitate to stop. I'm very comfortable with that as well.
Senator Peterson, I guess.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I guess my question had to do primarily with noise mitigation. I guess that's why when you were on that topic, I thought it might be appropriate. But, I'm from St. Cloud, and one thing we've done up there, the city owns that airport, and we had a few years back a development that wanted to go in within this area where we thought there was going to be problems. And so we actually required the developer to put a note on the deed of every property that informs the owner that's buying that home that they're buying in an airport area there will be overhead air traffic and that type of thing, trying to be proactive. Is there anything that MAC is doing to be proactive in terms of trying to head off any of those future noise mitigation liabilities?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, first of all, this program has been in existence now. We've actually had a recognized noise mitigation program since the 1960s, but in fact have formalized it when I came to the commission in 1977 when I became the first manager of noise abatement. And from 77 through the present time, our staff has grown in its technical capabilities and so forth. And we do conduct all sorts of noise meetings in the community. We make aware to each of the communities our noise mitigation program, the insulation programs available. As you may or may not know, the federal government determines what noise impact is. And noise impact at the federal level is defined as any home that's inside the aircraft noise contour of 65 decibels or higher. 65 decibels would be a 24-hour annualized average noise exposure level. In the Twin Cities, to give you a sense of space, the contour extends out to the northwest from the airport to just short of the shores of Lake Calhoun in South Minneapolis. That would be one of the longest kind of lobes that would reach out into the community. I'm familiar with St. Cloud. Bill Towle and I are good friends, your airport manager. I'm aware of the concerns that you've had about residential development and so forth on the north side of the airport. We don't have an actual deed requirement in the Twin Cities, but we do have an extensive notification program. The airport, because it's been here so long, is well established as being an airport that generates noise.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you see any scenario that allows some of that to end at all, or are you done with it and you will no longer have noise claims, or moving forward, do you see some of that liability ending?
Mr. Hamill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, do I see the end of noise claims and complaints? Probably not, just because the residential community changes hands and so forth. But what I will say is that we have actually gone into somewhere in the area of about 9,500 to 10,000 homes and actually made significant modifications to the property so that the interior noise level is not exposed to noise levels that exceed the federal guidelines. We still have about 3 more years of work to do on the fringes, the outer edges of those contours. And what the Metropolitan Airports Commission did was exceed the federal guidelines. We go out to the 60 DNL contour as opposed to the 65, with the highest contours close into the airport, somewhere in the area of 75 decibels, then 70, 65. We've gone out to the 60, and as the farther you go out, the broader these bands of these contours become. So there are more people residing, for example, in the 60 to 65 contour than people living in the 65 to 70 contour. We will complete the program, and we'll have acoustically mitigated the noise for nearly every home in the 60 DNL contour, which again is about 4,000, 5,000 homes beyond the federal guidelines. So we will be finished with that program from the perspective of the airport as far as financial investment. However, that does not necessarily mean that people will stop calling and complaining. While our noise complaints are down, as homes are sold and bought and sold, and new people move in, we'll receive phone calls, there will be questions. But the bottom line is that we have done all that we can possibly do, both financially and legally, in dealing with the homes that we've mitigated thus far. So we believe the airport's been responsible. It's been very aggressive. We have gone through some court challenges to deal with this issue and have resolved those issues. And, in fact, we will complete the noise mitigation program by the end of 2014.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. did I hear in your testimony you had a in excess of $1 billion in a deficit?
Not deficit. We have a, Mr. Chairman, Senator Loomer, we have a $1.74 billion of outstanding debt as a result of our airport expansion program between 1996 and 2006. And I actually have some discussion on those points as to what we did and why that debt exists and how we're dealing with it.
Mr. Chair, and is that just for runway modification or expansion, or is that in the housing area?
That is not, Mr. Chairman, that is not housing investment. That is purely improvement development of the airport itself, which means runways, terminal buildings, taxiways, roadway systems, and so forth.
Sir, could you tell me, you said that we exceed the neighborhoods of the federal guidelines on noise mitigation. Is that a choice that Minnesota as a policy has made to go in excess of what the minimum would be established by the federal government?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Loomer, yes, that's basically a decision of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. We chose to go beyond the 65 DNL contour and out to the 60 with a reduced program because they're farther away from the louder noise exposure, because those areas still generated literally thousands and thousands of complaints a year. Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport is unique in that it is a close-in urban airport. And back in the days when we took a look at the future viability of the airport back in the 1990s, we did an extensive study known as the 2010 plan, and we took a look at two kind of courses of action, two tracks. We called it the dual-track airport planning process. And one track was to take a look at building an entirely new airport somewhere outside the metropolitan, the high-density population of our metropolitan area. And the other course of action, or the other track, was to take a look at expanding the airport at its current site. After 5 or 6 years of study and analysis, forecasting and so forth, environmental work, it was decided by the commission and the legislature that we should stay at our current location and expand and protect the current site of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. The alternative choice, by the way, the Greenfield site development was a project of the Metropolitan Council, and they had identified a site about 5 miles south of Hastings, Minnesota, as being the most opportune location for a new airport if we built on a Greenfield site. Once the decision was made to stay where we are, that meant that we had a growing international airport nestled in a residential community. South Minneapolis, as you know, is a substantial community. It's a strong community. It's well-established. It's got financial strength and a very solid, strong, community-oriented population. We don't want to damage that or harm the metropolitan area, so what we did was voluntarily go out farther to acoustically mitigate the noise as best we can. Now, once you go outside of your home and walk down the street, if aircraft are flying overhead, you're still exposed. But when you're in your home, telephone conversation, watching television, radio, conversation at the dinner table, that has primarily been mitigated to meet or exceed federal standards.
I've been a realtor for a number of years, and I've kind of wondered about how far we as a government go to mitigate a noise problem for owners of a property who know where they're going to move into. They know that there's an airport nearby. They see the planes flying overhead. They know the noise when they are considering buying the property. And then once they move in, then they run to the government to cure the problem that they knew before they moved in. And I'm just wondering how far we can go on other area problems that people will run to mitigate their problem in their backyard. And I, you know, where do we draw the line? And with Minnesota now expanding beyond the federal zone that the federal government would cover, I'm at the point where I'm getting very reluctant to start curing people's problems when they know what kind of problem they're going to anticipate before they buy the property.
Senator Loomer, I over all the years that I've been with the commission, we've had this discussion on many occasions with all sorts of different philosophical approaches. The reality is that back in the 1970s and into the early 80s, where we were receiving somewhere in the vicinity of 18,000 to 20,000 complaints a year, we took a look at the population, and about half of the total population that was impacted by the airport were people who lived in their homes for a long, long time, more than 20 or 30 years before the noise grew to be what it is today. The reality is that the Metropolitan Airports Commission, or the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, grew way beyond what most people ever envisioned it would be. So the homes that were built in the early 1900s in South Minneapolis, for example, were not built to contain or to seal them from noise. It was obviously a climatic ceiling to keep the house warm in the wintertime, but did not eliminate or reduce noise impact to a great extent. And as a result, many of the people who lived in South Minneapolis, many of the people who lived in Bloomington and Ridgefield, folks who lived over in St. Paul, who lived underneath the flight paths, watched over the years dramatic and increasing noise levels. When we made the transition in the early 60s from propeller-driven aircraft to primarily jet aircraft, those very new early model jet aircraft were extremely loud. They were military derivatives. And that's when the noise roar kind of began. What we have done basically is tried to respond to that. We were urged by a variety of groups, including the legislature, to take a look at expanding that contour beyond the federal guideline. I can tell you with some confidence, quite a bit of confidence, that the 60 DNL exceeds any other airport's mitigation program in the country. We believe that we have gone far enough. We will complete this work. It's all funded, and we are within probably under $100 million of continued expenditure to finish this thing. And when we're done, we will have completed our obligation.
Mr. Chair, I was rehabbing a house once that was about 600 to 800 feet below the flight path, and a plane would fly over every 20 minutes. and it was during the very time that the DC-9s were being phased out. And DC-9s, I don't understand sound movement and the science of sound, but a DC-9 could take off. It had the two engines in the back along the tail.
Right.
And even though the plane was far, far away, that noise would just linger in the neighborhood like a thunder roll, and it would never go away. And now that, thank heaven, DC-9s are no longer in operation, and there is a marked improvement in the technology of jet engines, and they're a lot quieter than they were before. So it's good to hear that we've kind of reached our limits.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latimer, you point to an important point, and that is that as we move forward, technology is going to ultimately reduce to almost to a minimum extent the noise emissions from jet aircraft operations, as well as air quality issues that are a result of just the burning of the fuel. So I think what you're going to see is the contours probably staying about where they are today, maybe a little bit larger in the future. But that's just because of the sheer volume of operations will increase over time as more people travel and use the airport. But as far as exceeding the noise levels that we've experienced at the peak, I think that those days are behind us. And I think that we've been responsible as an organization, as a public agency. We've worked hard to keep the airport in its current location to serve the community in a convenient sort of a way rather than driving to south of Hastings. And we felt that it was an important obligation to satisfy once and for all, and we've now just about completed that program. But I understand your sympathy here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I was talking about – I'm sorry, any more questions?
Senator Reinert.
I'll wait, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I was talking about the funding of the Metropolitan Airports Commission, and the question I asked before we began the questions was how does and where does the Airports Commission generate its revenue? And basically, we do apply for aviation grants to the Federal Aviation Administration. A ticket is taxed 10%. That 10% goes to Washington, D.C., goes into the Aviation Trust Fund. The concept is if you use the system, you pay and contribute to support its operation. If you don't use the system, then you don't have to have a financial obligation or commitment to airports and aviation in the United States. So the aviation grant program is basically the airport applying back to the federal government for funding to fund authorized or approved projects approved by the FAA that warrant or qualify for funding. We probably contribute somewhere in the area of $25 to $35 million a year into the Aviation Trust Fund through ticket tax. We probably get back on an average year somewhere in the area of about $10 to $15 million. The rest of the money would go then to other airports that are smaller in size than ours that don't have the ability to generate the kinds of revenue that we do. It goes toward funding the Federal Aviation Administration, which is the air traffic control system, the air traffic controllers, and so forth. But basically, those dollars to the Aviation Trust Fund finance the operation of our national air transportation system, and we compete for those dollars on qualified projects. We can also sell bonds. We do charge a passenger facility charge of $4.50 for every departing passenger at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, and we also have net revenues from our various investments and other sources. These are the funds that are used to meet our capital obligations and pay our debt. We also have the ability to exercise a taxing authority. The legislature gave the MAC a 1/3 mill on all the real property of the Seven County metro area back in 1943. That, however, has not been exercised since the mid-1960s, and our overall plan for the Airports Commission is to not reignite that taxing authority, nor do we want to utilize it. We enjoy a AA- bond rating. It is one of the highest bond ratings of any airport in the United States. Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch's, all the rating agencies do rate us similarly. We have proven to have a very strong and a very solid financial model, and one that is self-supporting. Our debt coverage ratio is more than 200% of our current outstanding debt obligation on an annual basis, and we have in reserve 6 months of operating funds available to operate the airport if something catastrophic should happen. So where does money come from? 46% of our revenue comes from parking and concessions at the airport. When you park your car at the airport, that revenue goes two places. Comes to the commission and is used to either pay off the debt on that outstanding parking facility or used to maintain and operate the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. When you purchase in the terminal building a meal or a book or a magazine from one of the retail or food and beverage concessions, a percentage of their sales comes back to the Airports Commission in the form of revenue for us, and that's the concessions part of supporting our overall operation. 34% of our revenue comes from the airlines themselves through what we call airline rates and charges. When an airline lands at the airport, they pay a landing fee. That landing fee is about $2.25 per 1,000 pounds of landed weight. So on average, a commercial airliner would pay somewhere in the area of about $325 or so for every landing that takes place at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. More for larger airplanes, less for smaller airplanes. We also have, and they also pay, by the way, for the pavement that they park the aircraft on at the gate. They pay for the actual rent or lease of the gate lobby area. They pay a common use fee to the airport authority to use the concourses to get from the main terminal facility to the gates. They pay for office space, ticket counters, baggage claim carousels, maintenance facilities, and so forth on the airport.
Well, Mr. Hamill, is that included in the 325, or is that an addition?
That's an addition. The 325 is just the cost of landing, and then on top of that, all these other rates and charges apply. And what's interesting, however, Mr. Chairman, is that, and this is how we generate the revenue, is it gives us the AA- bond rating when we're evaluated by the financial community to sell bonds. But those rates and charges all accumulate, and I'll show you in a few moments that, in fact, while it sounds like there is a large number of charges and a large amount of money, in comparison to other airports, we are very, very competitive. And finally, 20% of our revenue comes from the rent of land, the rent of buildings that are non-airline related, terminal facilities, and utilities collection. And that provides us with kind of the sources of revenue that we use to operate MSP and our system of airports.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Just curious, having seen all the growth in the airport recently, the restaurants and sort of more upscale destination venues there, is that making a difference? Is that bringing in a lot more revenue?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, what you're looking at today is a major kind of a turn in the way we looked at our concessions in the terminal building. Back in the early 2000s, we looked at those concessions. We historically looked at them as being kind of necessary enterprises to meet the basic needs of travelers. The late 90s and the 2000s, we recognized this is a tremendous source of revenue for us, that in fact travelers who travel regularly and frequently are looking for improved amenities. So now you've seen the advent of retail venues that include clothing stores, shoe stores. I mean, you can literally, it's kind of a shopping mall, sort of an arrangement. We call it the North Star Crossing down the main corridor of our terminal building. Before recognition of the revenue opportunities here that were being missed, we were probably generating somewhere between $7 and $9 million a year in revenue from our concessions. Today it exceeds $20 million a year and is growing. And our goal is to continue to make improvements, which I'll discuss a little bit later on, make improvements at the airport to make those retail and food and beverage venues more attractive, healthier food available, higher quality items to meet the needs of travelers. And they've proven to be very, very important revenue enterprises for all large hub airports in the United States.
Well, Mr. Chair, right. I think that's great. That's a great strategy. And as someone who travels regularly, but not often. It's nice that some of the, you know, when you put charges on those of us who are flying and sort of the things you have to pay versus
yes.
the optional shopping, it's nice to, you know, those who want to spend the money can contribute more because they feel like shopping, and that's great. So it's a fun opportunity, but it also sort of makes it easier when you have to fly.
And, Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, also what we also have is a policy of street pricing at the airport plus an added percentage because there is a higher cost to do business at the airport from the standpoint of screening all the merchandise and goods that come into the airport and so forth and the handling and process. But, in fact, we try to maintain street pricing so that when you do come through an airport, whether you're the road warrior who's here every week or you come out once or twice a year and travel or maybe once every 5 years, that when you do come to the airport, generally speaking, you're not going to feel like a captive audience. You will be able to purchase most typical items at about a price you'd pay at a nearby shopping mall with an opportunity for about a 10% bump in price just because of the cost of getting goods and services to the airport. But we don't want people to feel as if now they're at the airport they're going to pay three times or two times what they would find anyplace else. So, if I could shift, Mr. Chairman, to economic impact, and I hope I'm not getting too long. I'm trying to give you the background at the same time answer the questions.
You're fine.
Okay, thank you. Economic impact of the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. I would tell you that I believe that the 3,100 acres that MSP occupies in South Minneapolis is the most economically valuable property in the state of Minnesota. There's more revenue generated on those 3,000 acres than any piece of real estate between Chicago and Seattle and as far south as St. Louis. The total annual income generated is somewhere in the area of about $10.7 billion a year directly infused into the economy of the state of Minnesota and the metropolitan community more centrally. 153,000 jobs are tied directly to the airport, both directly and indirectly, so I've got to be very careful here. There are 17,000 or so people who work at the airport every day, who come out, provide their services, and go home. But there are 120,000 additional people out there whose work is related to the airport in one form or another, whether they're consultants, construction people, suppliers of goods and services to the airport or airport businesses. There's a tremendous impact on employment in the state of Minnesota. Of the 17,000 people who work on the airport every day, about 3,000 of those are your food and beverage and retail stores, servers and so forth, and folks who help you with your needs at the airport. The Federal Aviation Administration has a large component of individuals, air traffic controllers, FAA inspectors, and so forth. The Transportation Security Administration, we all are very familiar with the TSA and their security inspection procedures and so forth. There's a large complement of those folks. Airline employees, well beyond airline flight attendants and pilots, management supervisors, and so forth. And, of course, the Metropolitan Airports Commission itself, which is the smallest of these enterprises with about 575 employees, are also located at the airport. Those 153,000 jobs generate about $6 billion a year in annual personal income to people who are affiliated with the airport's operation, $1.4 billion in local purchases by entities and enterprises on the airport, and about $626 million in state income, local taxes to the state of Minnesota and the local jurisdictions around the airport. We stop to consider that the Airports Commission receives no general tax support from the state of Minnesota, yet the enterprise contributes $625 million plus a year into the economy. That's, I think, a pretty good trade-off, and it indicates that the airport is a contributor to the economic vitality of the state and the communities. This industry, air transportation, is volatile, and it is very cyclical. If you were to take a look at the last 10 years from 2000 through 2009 and take a look at what's happened with air transportation statistics, such as the passenger activity and overall operations, that is the number of takeoffs and landings, it's been a pretty rocky road. And I'll just give you some broad numbers. In 2000, we had about 36.7 million total passengers per year. The following year, that 36.7 after 9/11 dropped to 33.7, an immediate one-year drop of 3 million passengers a year. It continued to decline all the way through 2004, where we saw a slight recovery coming back up to 36 million, with our peak year over the last 10 years being the year 2005, where we peaked out at 37,660,000 passengers. At that time, MSP was ranked as the seventh largest airport in America, the 12th largest airport in the world. We were the headquarters of Northwest Airlines at the time, which was one of the largest airline companies, and as a result, we had a very, very solid complement of pilots and flight attendants based in the Twin Cities, plus I think about a 6,000-person workforce of mechanics and reservations folks and ticketing people and so forth. It was a significant operation. Since 2005, however, following the bankruptcy filing of Northwest Airlines in September of 2005, we saw a decline, 35 million, 34, 9, 34 million. And last year, in 2009, we got dropped all the way down to 32.3 million passengers, another 2 million passengers drop over the preceding 2 years. So it's a little confusing, but the bottom line is I'm trying to show that large numbers in 2000, declining until about 2005 when it came back again, peak at 2005, and then declining again. The combination of the 9/11 events, the bankruptcy of Northwest Airlines in 2005, in 2008 the acquisition of Northwest Airlines by Delta Airlines, and the efficiency and synergies that Richard Anderson, the CEO of Delta, talked about as far as adjusting to the new large merged airline company, and then of course the impact of the recession in 2009, which basically cut out almost a dramatic amount of leisure travel. That is, people who traveled to visit family and friends, vacations and so forth, dramatically impacted our numbers. The good news, however, is that the cyclical cycle does recover, and the cycle is now recovering. In the latter part of 2010, we anticipated and did realize growth, and the numbers of 2010 did exceed the passenger levels of 2009 by about 1.5%. And we are projecting continued growth in 2011 and 2012, as is the federal government, the state demographer, and a variety of other organizations that take a look at transportation statistics. The important point is that it's a very volatile industry. We've watched major changes in this industry, particularly since the Deregulation Act was passed in 1978. And as a result, we'll see operations and passenger activity fluctuate over time. However, over the long term, we expect to see dramatic and substantial growth, and that's why we are preparing now to look toward the next 20 years of what needs to be done at the airport to make us competitive. One of the measures that is used in the industry to take a look at how efficient an airport is managed and operated is a term called cost per plane passenger. This is a metric or a measure that basically lays out for us the average cost to the airline to transfer a passenger through our terminal facilities. Whether they're coming from New York with a stop in Minneapolis, St. Paul, en route to Seattle, and you transfer from one flight to the other, this is how much it costs the airline to make that transfer. Or if it's an origination destination passenger, someone who is living in the Twin Cities, who is traveling to Los Angeles, who comes to the airport, parks his or her car, gets on board, and departs. This is the average cost of processing a passenger by the carrier. Our goal is to be in the lower one-third of the largest 29 airports in the United States. These are called large hub airports. And a large hub airport is an airport that transports at least 1% of the total passenger capacity per year. We rank about number 12 or 13th in that ranking of those top 29 airports. But in fact, we are one of the lower cost airports in the nation. The average cost per plane passenger in 2010 was $10.07 per passenger. The highest, the most expensive airports were in the area of $18 to $19.50 per passenger. Minneapolis-St. Paul in 2010 was $5.85, or almost just about half of the national average. What that means is that MSP, when you take into consideration all those charges that were charged to the airline companies, the landing fees, the rental and office space, square footage, parking the airplane on the ramp, the use of the gate, baggage carousels, all of those expenses when put together and divided by the total passengers still put us just actually a hair over being in the bottom quarter, but solidly in the bottom third of overall cost to the airlines. And what that means to us is that airline companies don't have to look at Minneapolis-St. Paul as being an expensive airport, therefore causing pause. We want more service. We want more choices. We want more airlines. The cost of operating here is very, very competitive. When you look at the airline companies that serve Minneapolis-St. Paul, virtually every single airline in America of any notable size, with the exception of JetBlue as a domestic carrier, serves the Twin Cities. Most recently, we've seen Southwest Airlines come to our community in 2009. Alaska Airlines came to Minneapolis-St. Paul in 2008 We are constantly searching, looking, and recruiting new airline service to maintain competitive opportunities. Fully recognizing, however, that Delta Airlines is 80% of our total operation. Everyone else is about 20%. And that's a follow-on from the acquisition of Northwest Airlines. That's what existed before Northwest was acquired by Delta. On the international side, we're also looking at recruiting and looking for new international service. In the last year, we've talked with Lufthansa in Frankfurt, Germany. We've talked with British Air in London, encouraging those airlines to consider our service to the Twin Cities nonstop to Europe. We've also talked with airline companies serving South America and Central America. And most recently, when it was announced that Delta Airlines was going to serve Minneapolis-St. Paul nonstop Mexico, which started last December. The bottom line is that the Metropolitan Airports Commission has never denied and always tried to accommodate every request of an airline company to serve the Twin Cities. Now let me move to kind of what's happened in the last 10 years at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. And this gets back to the question of that $1.74 billion outstanding debt obligation. We had a program called the MSP 2010 plan. It was actually originated by legislation passed here in 1989 called the Airport Planning Act. And in that Airport Planning Act, the legislature directed the Airports Commission to take a look at two courses of action in preparing for the future. And this was the beginning of that dual-track airport planning process I talked about, the Greenfield site versus expanding the airport at its current location. Once a decision was made to expand at our current site and keep the airport where it was located, and that was, by the way, decided because we looked at forecast numbers, we looked at FAA, we looked at the economy, we looked at the establishment of businesses in the community, the Fortune 500 corporations, the travel patterns of this community. Looking at all those factors and variables, it was determined that this airport could grow to meet future growth demand through the year 2020. We then developed a midstream plan called the 2010 plan, and basically from 1996 to 2006, we expanded the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport to what you see today. That total expansion, including some additional projects that were not in the original plan, reached $3.2 billion in overall expenses. What do you get for $3.2 billion over the course of a 10-year construction program? You build the Hubert H. Humphrey Terminal Building, now known as Terminal 2. You build all the parking facilities associated with the Humphrey Terminal Building. You build a new north-south runway on the west side of the airport parallel to Cedar Avenue, runway 1735. That's an 8,000-foot runway surface that is utilized every day. You build new de-icing pads on the airport to accommodate all of the concerns of de-icing and treating aircraft before they depart under adverse weather conditions. And then you use that de-icing pad to capture that de-icing material, those chemicals, and transfer them to holding ponds in the airport where they can be either pumped to other facilities for reuse and or trickled to the Waste Control Commission facilities for proper cleansing before that water is released into the river. You build new auto rental facilities on the airport. You build 16,000 new parking ramps, and to put that in perspective for you, typically a 5,000-vehicle parking ramp will cost about $100 million. We've spent about three times that building 16,000 parking spaces on the airport. You build two tram systems to accommodate the needs of travelers going down the very long C concourse, so you can now ride the above-ground-grade tram out nearly the entire length of the C concourse. You can also ride the underground tram that takes you from the lower level of the main terminal facility, Lindbergh Terminal 1, out to the end of the parking facilities that were newly constructed. You build a whole new inbound-outbound roadway system. You build a transit center in the airport to accommodate taxi cabs and city buses and longer-haul buses and vans. You contribute $87 million to the light rail transit system so that, in fact, people who are traveling to the airport can get downtown or to the Mall of America from the airport using the LRT system. And by the way, the reverse of that is that people who used to have to ride for an hour to an hour and 30 minutes to get from the Lake Street area of the south of Minneapolis to the airport to work would take an hour to an hour and a half to take the bus with all the transfers, can now get on the LRT and be at work in 20 minutes and have an opportunity to be employed in our terminal facilities. And then there's also a connector between the C concourse and the G concourse. These are the two long extensions. So the people arriving at the end of one of those extensions don't have to walk all the way in and all the way around that horseshoe, but can make a shortcut cut across. That's what's been done in the last 10 years at the airport from 1996 to 2006 as part of that $3.2 billion expansion. We have remaining on that $3.2 billion, the $1.74 billion remaining, and the financial mechanisms and so forth to continue to fund and pay off that debt obligation. We don't stop with the 2010 plan. In fact, while we had all those primary facilities completed in 2006, just looking back at last year alone in 2010, looking at facilities, we renamed the terminal buildings by identifying them by number. We now have Terminal 1 representing the Lindbergh Terminal and Terminal 2, which is the Humphrey facility. We did that because thousands of passengers a year would go to the wrong terminal building to catch their flights. Now when you come into the airport, you'll see Terminal 1, then you'll see the listing of the airline companies that serve Terminal 1 and Terminal 2 with airlines serving Terminal 2. So if you know the airline you're on, don't worry about Lindbergh and Humphrey. Don't worry about anything other than there's the terminal that's got my airline. This is where I need to make a turn. We have literally eliminated the complaints from people who missed flights because they went to the wrong facility and became confused on the roadway system. We've expanded in 2010 security checkpoints at the airport. Checkpoints 2 and 10 have been broadly expanded. We now have a guaranteed parking accommodation at the airport called ePark Elite, where if you wish, if you're a frequent traveler, you can actually rent a permanent spot on the airport. It won't be your spot necessarily, but space is available, so they'll always be available to you if you're a year-round parker. We have the Skyway that now connects the LRT system over at Humphrey Terminal, Terminal 2, with the Humphrey Terminal building through the parking facilities, and new valued parking on the airport as well. Area food and beverage, the La Brea Bakery Cafe opened last July. Certix Flights opened last August. The new Blackberry store opened in September. We are continuously looking for improving venues to meet the traveler's needs and improve the traveler's experience. And those businesses that are not quite as successful leave, and new, more enterprising opportunities are created every year. In the area of technology, I think if you've passed the airport, you've seen all the new flight displays that give you flight information on the new LED blue boards across the terminal facility. They will tell you where your flight, arriving and departing flights, and your gate location. And downstairs will also tell you where your bag is located to go to the proper carousels. The TSA has instituted new full-body imaging technology in the terminal building. And while it has some controversy, and that is being dealt with at the federal level, this new technology does enhance and improve the overall safety of our air transportation system. We just recently opened up, turned on new touchscreen digital directories. These are about 8 feet tall and basically look like a great big personal information device where you touch the screen if you want to go to a flight, if you want to go to a retail venue or a food and beverage venue. You can find your way throughout the facility by going to one of these brand new touchscreen digital directories. And we also have a mobile app at the airport called GoHow Airport. GoHow Airport is available on your iPhone or your BlackBerry and will soon be available on Verizon. But we're attempting to keep technology on the forefront as well and make certain that people can navigate and find their way to whatever venue they choose in the process of using our facility. Okay. Moving toward the end of my presentation, let me just wrap up by talking about what we call the Long-Term Comprehensive Plan, or our 2030 plan. This is a look forward from 2010 through 2030. It's a 20-year look into the future. Remember I told you that we have, the present have about 33 million passengers a year passing through the airport. That number will grow over the next 20 years to more than 55 million passengers, or about a 20 million passenger a year increase over time. At the present time, we have 127 gates between Terminal 1 and Terminal 2 at the airport. That must grow to approximately 155 gates by 2030 to accommodate the growth in the demand. Now, I say approximately because these numbers, as you look forward, this is our best guess based on data we have today. We will, in fact, modify these plans over time. But generally speaking, you'll see an increase in gates of from 127 to 155. We're going to need an additional 40,000 parking spaces, a total of 40,000 parking spaces on the airport, up from the current 22,000 that are available today. We will not need any more new runways, taxiways, and aprons and so forth at the airport. In fact, we're seeking a balance on capacity, and there are two capacities at the airport that we have to deal with. There's an airside capacity. That answers the question, can aircraft take off and land and not exceed the capacity of our runways, taxiways, ramps, and parking areas? And the reality is that we have built out our runways with the addition of that new north-south runway on the west side so that we have capacity to handle the traffic that would transport 55 million-plus passengers a year. But we don't have capacity on the land side, that is the roadway systems, the terminal gates, those facilities and parking. Those facilities need to be improved upon. And what we will do over time is bring the capacity of the land side, the terminal facility, up to match the capacity of our runway system. We will do this in four phases. And I won't detail the phases for you, but I will tell you that there are five-year increments from 2010 to 2015, 2015 to 20, 20 to 25, and 25 to 30. We will only develop and expand facilities when there's a demonstrated demand. We will not do the greenfield thing where you build and they will come. We have a long-standing history and a successful one of building only after there's an established, demonstrated need on a long-term basis. And the airline companies who request, because of their expansion, request these gates, they sign on the bottom line a long-term lease to pay for the facilities that they will use. And once we have a demand and a funding stream, we will then build the facilities as necessary. How much will this new program cost? Between now and 2030, we will spend between $2 and $2.4 billion additional dollars expanding the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. But we will not need and we will not exercise our taxing authority or general tax revenues from the state of Minnesota. This overall long-term comprehensive plan has already been reviewed by the Metropolitan Council and approved by their board and, of course, approved by the Board of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. At the end of the day, what we will end up doing is adding approximately 28 gates to the current Terminal 1, Terminal 2 facilities on the airport, with the more visible expansion being in the Humphrey Terminal building, adding 24 gates there and 4 gates at the Lindbergh Terminal. Ultimately, what will drive this is a decision of Delta Airlines taking over the entire Terminal 1 or the Lindbergh Terminal building in the future. We expect that over the next 4 or 5 years, Delta will advise us that they need additional gates to handle their growth and to accommodate their system. And as a result, we'll have to relocate airline companies that are currently in the Terminal 1 facility, relocating over to the Humphrey facility. And that's why the growth in gates focusing over at the Humphrey facility. One last wrap-up, one last topic, really, of our airports. I told you in the beginning of this presentation that we have 7 airports. 6 of them are what we call reliever airports. We call them relievers because their purpose is to take traffic demand away from MSP. We are trying to preserve the capacity of the international airport to accommodate the needs of large, high-capacity commercial airliners and large cargo-carrying aircraft. That means that everyone else could go someplace else. So the corporate jets, the private recreational flyers, the small business operator that doesn't require 8,000 to 10,000 feet of runway can choose to go to St. Paul downtown or one of the other smaller airports based on the type of aircraft they have and, quite frankly, where they are going to conduct their business. You don't need to land at MSP if your business is up in Maple Grove. Fly into the Anoka County Airport and shorten up the distance and park your airplane at an airport that can accommodate your needs. We are, however, in a time of transition. And what's happened is that with the economic down cycle and the reduction for the demand of pilot training based on just the economy and the industry itself, we're seeing significant declines in the overall flight operations taking place on those smaller airports. Let me give you an example. If you took a look at takeoffs and landings on those 6 reliever airports in the year 2000, they would total about 800,000 takeoffs and landings a year. In 2009, it had dropped to half that, down to 400,000 operations a year. In 2000, we had 1,820 aircraft based on MAC reliever airports. Today, that number has dropped from 1,820 down to about 1,575. The general aviation community is as volatile as the air transportation or the airline business as well, and they have experienced their economic cycles. Basically, what's happened over the course of the last 15 or 20 years is that there's been a declining demand for the training of airline pilots, and a lot of the businesses on these smaller airports are in the training business. And so if you wanted to get a private pilot's license or a commercial pilot's license or an instrument rating, you would go out to a private business on one of our airports and pay for private lessons to learn how to fly an airplane just as if it's the same way you learn to drive your car. But with certain changes in the airline industry and a leveling off of pilot hiring, the demand for those services has basically dissipated to the point where many of the businesses on our airport and the number of operations that take place there, which is the practice of landings and takeoffs, has diminished. And as a result, demand's down. We are moving from a kind of a recreational environment to a small business, medium-sized business environment where, while we'll always have recreational flyers and people who fly for the sheer enjoyment, we're seeing a significant increase in those people who fly for business, who fly single and twin-engine prop airplanes and small jets in support of their business activity. And as a result, we will see a stabilization, not continued decline, and we'll see a balancing off between the recreational private flyer and the new business owner flyer who goes about his business using the airplane out of one of our reliever airports. The cost of aviation has also significantly impacted the ownership, private ownership of aircraft, and as a result, just the sheer cost has driven the numbers down. There are, however, a couple of events coming up in the future. There's one category of aircraft called very light jets. This would be the new, very small, typically six-passenger jets that would be flown by an owner-operator with proper qualifications to be a substitute for flying on the commercial airlines. Very light jets were right on the verge of taking off at about the time that we saw high energy costs, high fuel costs, and quite frankly, the collapse of our economy. But we believe that we will see the VLJs, the very light jets, reappear in big numbers in the next 5 to 10 years, where an owner who can afford a $2 million airplane of a small business can put business associates in the airplane and fly and not deal with the congestion at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. Another growing area is what we call light sport aircraft. The cost of aviation has become prohibitive for most people, but the desire to learn to fly is still there. And there's a low-cost way of learning how to fly and a low-cost vehicle toward aircraft ownership. For somewhere around $100,000, a small flight training business could acquire smaller airplanes, two-passenger airplanes, with more efficient engine technologies that, in fact, could be used for training pilots to acquire their credentials to at least qualify and compete for airline jobs in the future, as well as folks who want to buy their own airplane or multiple individuals who want to partner the purchase of an airplane can buy these smaller aircraft and enjoy them for pleasure or business use. The bottom line, I think, is that what I've described to you today, and I thank you very much for your patience and for my long presentation, is that we live in a volatile industry. We adapt to it on a regular basis. We see cycles that go from strong growth to flat and declining levels of activity in both the commercial side at the airline level as well as in the smaller aircraft side within the general aviation community. But the Airports Commission does have the ability to be flexible and respond. We try to run our airport like a business. If we can pay for it, we buy it. If we can't pay for it, we don't. We run one of the safest operations in the United States, and we're, I think, the only remaining airport of the large hub airports in the nation that has not experienced a fatal air accident or crash in the last 60 years. That is a combination of hard work and a little bit of luck. But the bottom line is that we are proud of our system. We've got a small staff, the smallest hub staff in the nation. However, I think one that's truly dedicated and enjoys its work and finds it rewarding. And with that, I will make myself available, Mr. Chairman, for any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. Hamill. Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, that was my knock on wood. Never hurts. I just have a couple questions, Mr. Chair, if you'd indulge me. The first one, coming back to the noise issue, I thought we'd let you get through your presentation and then revisit that topic. I represent Duluth, we've got Rochester, we've got St. Cloud all at the table, and I know in the past we've had conversations about sending more cargo traffic out of MSP, and I'm just curious as to your comments on that. We don't tend to have the same noise issues that the Twin Cities has, and frankly, we would welcome the cargo traffic. And generally your comments on the relationship, not just between MSP and the reliever airports, but MSP and the regional airports.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, let me break that into kind of two responses. First of all, cargo has been interesting, and at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, if you were to come to our airport 10 or 15 years ago, you would have seen as many as six or seven Boeing 747s operated as cargo-only aircraft by Northwest Airlines. We had a very, very large cargo presence with cargo flights, some going to Europe, but predominantly going to Asia. Northwest Airlines, in the last 15 years, has literally gotten out of the large cargo-moving business. And what's happened is we've seen FedEx and UPS enter the market in the small package area and larger aircraft doing the heavy cargo hauling, but not anywhere near the volume that we've seen in the past. We've actually asked the business community, because Minneapolis-St. Paul is the home of 20 Fortune 500 corporations, and we manufacture lots of goods that go international to the world marketplace. We've asked those corporations, do you want improved cargo facilities? Do you want us to take a look at beginning to expand cargo operations and activity? And the reality is that they say that the current operation is satisfactory in meeting their needs. But that operation is as follows. Instead of bringing your goods out to the airport and putting them on a cargo airplane nonstop to Asia or Europe or Central and South America, what happens is over half of all the manufactured goods in the metropolitan area are trucked every night to Chicago, where they are transferred from a truck to the airplane in Chicago nonstop to most destinations around the world. So long as that kind of a system exists and functions to meet the needs of businesses in the state of Minnesota, there's not a great deal of incentive for us to go out and try to build facilities to try to drive that. When the demand is created and when businesses in Minnesota tell us that they have a need for concentrated cargo activity nonstop out of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, we'll then appropriately respond. FedEx and UPS do fly throughout the state of Minnesota with large and small aircraft. There are flights every day and every night from Rochester and Duluth and Thief River Falls and International Falls and Huron, South Dakota. They come in every evening, transfer their loads to the larger airplanes, which depart and fly to either Louisville, Kentucky, if you're UPS, or Memphis, Tennessee, if you are FedEx. As far as our relationship with airports around the state of Minnesota, the Minnesota Council of Airports is a group that I participate with, and so do my staff. I speak to their annual convention every year. Brian Ricks, who's the manager of the airport in Duluth, Bill Towell in St. Cloud, Rochester, we all meet. Bemidji, the airport managers around the state meet about four times a year and sit down and just discuss what's happening within our respective airports. Each of those meetings always come back to any way of looking at more air service for Duluth or for Thief River Falls or for Bemidji. In the case of St. Cloud, they've now lost all their air service, so they're saying to us, is there some way that MAC can help us take a look at getting to Delta to provide service to St. Cloud? And maybe from St. Cloud, not back to the Twin Cities, but maybe to Chicago or out to Denver and pick up some of that Northwest metropolitan community and that St. Cloud community activity. Those discussions take place. We are more than willing and able to work with the community and the airports. We have a good working relationship. Many of us have been friends for many, many years. We have tried to drive traffic to Duluth, traffic to Rochester, but the reality is that the vast majority of the population of the state is in the Twin Cities metro area, and as a result, this is the largest magnet in the state toward drawing activity and traffic. But we work together to try to find alternative transportation choices.
Okay. Hello. Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question. You answered both my questions in those comments, but I just would encourage you to continue to do that, I think, as we strengthen other transit connections between Rochester, St. Cloud, Duluth, and the Twin Cities. It allows us, sort of to come back to the noise issue, to spread some of that traffic out to the other airports, the other communities where it's not as big an issue. I mean, frankly, we've got the 148 flying in Duluth, and people think it's pretty cool when right. things are in the air and making noise. So as those connections continue to develop, please continue those conversations.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Reinert, you have the longest runway in the state. It's 11,000 feet. You have 747 international traffic that stops for fuel stops. There's no question that Duluth and Rochester both have the capacity and the ability, and if we have an opportunity, we will work with your airports respectively to improve that situation.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Senator Harrington, Mr. Hamill first, congratulations on your safety record. I think it is impressive, although I would probably prefer a wing and a prayer to knocking on wood. Senator Harrington.
Thank you, Senator Brandon. I have actually two real questions and one sort of broad background piece. The two questions are, number one, on Holman Field and how flood mitigation efforts down there have affected the use of the field and just general volume that's coming in and out of Holman. And then just a little more background on security at both the main airport and at the regional airports. With an airport right in the back door of the state capitol, security was often a concern of mine as the chief of police in St. Paul. So,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Harrington, first looking at St. Paul Downtown Airport, we have spent
St. Paul today, the total cost.
If you include the safety areas and the construction of the subterranean drainage system underneath the airport, plus the construction of the wall around the airport that's basically the dike that keeps the river water off the airport, we've spent approaching $40 million on improvements at that airport. With the construction of that flood dike, we basically have secured the St. Paul Downtown Airport from any real serious threat of closure due to flooding of the airfield. I'm saying that very carefully, Senator, because there's always the possibility, and I'm saying it with some caution because of this particular year where we've had remarkable snowfall in Minnesota all over the state, record-breaking snowfall. where the melt could, in fact, drive the river above the 100-year flood level and could, again, threaten the airport. But for the flood conditions that have occurred since 1965 to present, the dike that has been built, the flood wall that's been built, would, in fact, contain the water outside the airport and would let the airport remain unaffected by the floods. With one exception, that is when the flood wall, there's a permanent portion of that wall, and then there's a mobile portion that can be constructed, set up, and taken down. When we put up the wall in the mobile area on the south end of the airport, we do end up shortening the runway, and there is some hydrology pressure issues regarding the weight of aircraft that can land on a runway when the river is flooding. So we can stay operational, but we may not be able to accommodate all the aircraft that want to use the St. Paul Downtown Airport. But for all practical purposes, the flood solved our problem of flooding out 3M and the major Minnesota corporations that have aircraft based down there. Moving to security, as you may or may not know, the MAC has its own police department and its own fire department. That's part of the 575 employees who work at the Airports Commission. Our department, our police department, is very much focused and works with all the police departments in the metro area on safety and security issues. We are well aware of and very attuned to the terrorist threat situation. The Moscow airport is the example of the most recent event that took place that kind of shakes this industry. We are in cooperation working with the local police departments. We work with the Secret Service. We work with the FBI and a variety of other law enforcement organizations at the national and international level. We participate and work together on tracking individuals. We are asked to apprehend and or we notify other agencies at destination points when someone is traveling who is suspicious. We have had some controversy associated with our security program. You'll recall the detaining of the six imams a couple of years ago. While controversial and while criticized in some respects for that action, the reality is that we would rather be safe than sorry. We learned a great deal from that experience in coordinating with other agencies, but the bottom line is that security is an important part of our operation, and we depend upon our partnership and mutual aid with the surrounding cities to make certain that we all together know and understand the needs of our airport.
Thank you.
Senator Chamberlain.
First, I just want to say great job. I've always enjoyed my experience out there. You know, over the years, we always say, well, when will they finish building out here? When will this mess end? But it really is a great job. The experience has been good. Getting in and out of there is great. So I just, you know, it's not often folks come here and we say great work, and all without taxpayer money. So that's really, really wonderful. How much revenue do you take in a year? I had 240. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chamberlain, $240 million is close. It's within a couple million dollars annually.
Okay, thank you.
I have one question. On the leasing of the retail space you were discussing earlier, how's that? What percentage of the airport is occupied at this point?
I'm pausing for a moment because I can't tell you exactly offhand, but I would tell you that more than 90% of the available venue, let me pause. We have one area in the upper level of the Lindbergh Terminal, Terminal 1, on the second level that's currently vacant but will be occupied but not currently leased, but will be leased in the near future. But more than 95% of our facility is currently leased and has active and involved either retail or food and beverage venues available to the traveling public.
Mr. Hamill, how do you determine a tenant if there's a lot of demand for space, which I would assume there is? How does the airport commissioner, what's the process for determining who gets that space?
We have, the commission has a very involved competitive bidding process that quite frankly comes up on a reoccurring basis every six or so years. In fact, it's interesting you should ask the question because the commission is considering the extension of some leases in the terminal facility today with the existing vendors. Back about, I'll say, six, 7 years ago, we went through a significant overhaul of our leasing policies and procedures and basically determined that we wanted to provide competing concessionaires in the terminal building. There are many organizations companies out there that basically would love to provide all the concessions in an airport terminal facility. What we decided was that we wanted multiple concession areas in that building. They could be large organizations, but they would have to bring a variety of services to the airport. And we required that they compete with one another so that, in fact, the passenger would have a choice of venue, the choice of kind of store or restaurant they were going to go to, and there would be price competition so the pricing would not become a monopoly. So what we basically do, Mr. Chairman, is bid out these venues every half a dozen years or so. And other than this unique request that we have at the present time to extend because of some circumstances, we do require significant investment as part of these extensions and improvements in venues. The businesses on the airport that don't do very well kind of self-elect to disappear. They'll notify us when they're no longer performing, or they'll notify the prime concessionaire that they're no longer able to meet the financial obligations, and then they work in accommodation to leave and seek out a new venue to come to the airport. We do it through these large concessioning enterprises, however. If you, for example, want to start up a shop or a store of some sort at the airport, you could not do that unless you partnered with one of the three large concessionaires in the facility, just because of the complexity, the financial obligations, and what it takes to provide and run a business at the airport.
Any other questions from members? I've seen none and no other business before the committee. We are not going to meet Wednesday because of the state of the state. And so with that, Mayor Chair.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just say one, thank you very much. There are some new faces here today, some old ones, but some new ones. It's rare that we have an opportunity to sit down and actually talk with a committee at this length with this level of detail, and I want to tell you that I would truly appreciate your patience and your understanding and your attention today. And let me offer a couple of thoughts. It might be worthwhile, given the responsibility of this committee, to, when the weather's better, work with Mitch Killian and our staff. Mitch is our legislative representative, our liaison, to come on out to the airport. Let's get a bus and let's bring you out for a couple of hours and take you through the facilities and show you kind of what we've done and what we have planned for the future, because this thing really is an important engine for the economy of the state. And I say publicly when I speak to groups, if there's a decision made to slow the growth of the operation of the airport, that's a decision to slow the growth and the economic opportunity for the state of Minnesota. This is a jobs generator. And as money becomes available and as we begin some of these construction programs, we will put not hundreds but thousands of people to work building facilities and then managing those facilities and occupying those facilities when they're up and running. And it would be very much worth your while, I think, to come on out and take a look and see firsthand and ask questions. Also, if I might, Mitch Killian is our legislative staff person, and sitting next to him is Tom Anderson, our general counsel. Any questions at all, please get a hold of Tom or call me directly or Mitch. And we'd be happy to respond to any of your needs. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hamill.